On all my bills. Same with the mayor's.
And your bill. House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Good morning, colleagues. I would simply note that commerce is obviously on the mend. The train was twice as long this morning as usual and held me up at the crossing. We're opening the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 26. And we will hear from LRO.
Thank you. HJR 26 would allow taxing districts to introduce a local option levy to voters in a November election in an even year. The difference between these levies and the current local option levies is that the levies would not be subject to the limitations of Section 11 or Section 11B of the Constitution. That is to say, they would not be part of the calculations for the Measure 5 limits of $5 per $1,000 real market value for schools or $10 per $1,000 real market value for general government. Additionally, the levies would last for a period approved by the voters of up to 10 years. This differs from the current limits for local option levies of 5 years for non-capital projects and up to 10 years for capital projects.
Thank you. Mr. Novak, you have a panel? Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Novak. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities, which represents all 242 cities in the state. Together, these cities contain more than 70% of the state population. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of HJR 26, the local control referral. This is a simple yet important constitutional referral that would allow all local governments the ability to simply ask their local voters for any new voter-approved local operating levies to have a time frame of up to 10 years rather than the current 5-year limit, and provide that the limitations that result in compression not be applicable to these voter-approved levies. HJR 26 would give voters the opportunity to place more control in the hands of Oregon communities and allow local residents the ability to determine their community's levels of essential services, basic needs such as police, fire, libraries, and schools, putting local decisions in the hands of those best prepared to know how to meet the needs of their own neighborhoods. Currently, they're prevented from adequately addressing their needs by restrictions from Measure 5 and 50. No exceptions, no matter what the need, no matter what the local decision. These restrictions include an arbitrary dollar limit per thousand on property tax, regardless of voter intent. This is a limit on property tax of $5 per thousand for schools and $10 per thousand for other local governments. If local voters decide community needs are beyond these limits, the statewide dictated restrictions kick in and reduce or compress to the $5 or $10 limit, essentially overturning the will of the local voters. Since its inception, fully half of Oregon communities have become mired in compression, with many unable to meet the demands placed on them to provide basic services, even if the voters approve greater funding. To provide just some perspective on this, Mr. Hill will go into a little greater detail in a moment. For the 2010-11 tax year, of the total local government police property taxes levied, 19.5% was lost to compression. One-fifth. In the 2009-10 tax year, more than half of Oregon's 242 cities were under compression, resulting in over $15.6 million in lost revenue to cities statewide. And in this document on page 3, there's a little bit more information on some of the losses to cities. Again, these are resources local voters approved because they deemed them necessary to fund basic services. Yet these resources will never be collected and are lost forever due to compression. To provide local governments and schools greater efficiency, HJR 26 also allows for longer-term decision-making and planning. Currently, local operating levies are under a time limitation of up to 5 years. Allowing for longer time frames in many circumstances has the potential to save money and reduce uncertainty. For example, a community wishing to have or maintain a police staffing level through a levy will utilize time and resources putting the measure before the voters, and when successful, then use a part of their five-year window to recruit and train the officers. However, very often, just when the recruited officers have become fully integrated into the community's law enforcement efforts, the community may then find itself on the cusp of another vote to reauthorize that levy due to the five-year limitation. HJR 26 looks to reform the one-size-fits-all limits these measures superimposed on a statewide basis. What might work best for Portland or Astoria isn't necessarily the best option for Corvallis or Sisters. Local voters should be able to vote without having their vote partially or fully set aside by these compression limitations. And let's not forget that Oregon voters have recently recognized flaws with property tax limitations and been amenable to making changes. Voters amended the double majority in 2008 by 56.6%, and in 2010 were willing to change the definitions of capital construction by an even wider electoral margin. With the state, cities, schools, and other local governments all struggling to find a way to meet their responsibilities, giving local communities a greater say in their own affairs may help relieve some pressure on the state as each of you and your fellow legislators continue to have difficult decisions, especially here within this committee. Cities, local governments, schools, and state government form a network of services that support Oregon's social and economic infrastructure. As we all work to strengthen Oregon's economic health, each level of government must be enabled to meet its challenges and provide its services effectively and efficiently. Empowering local decision-making on local issues is critical. Local voters need all the potential tools to effectively respond to each community's unique demands and responsibilities. I'll close by thanking the revenue co-chairs for their interest in this matter, and of course Representative Cannon for his original efforts in shepherding this idea on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. And with that, Mr. Hill's prepared more technical testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Larry Hill. I am a senior financial analyst with the City of Eugene, and I work in the budget analysis division of the Financial Services Department. Normally, Brenda Wilson would be here representing the city's views. She's in Washington, D.C., representing the city there this week. So I'm stepping in for her. I work with property tax issues quite a bit on behalf of the city, so I'll speak from that perspective. The City of Eugene urges your support for HJR 26, which would send a constitutional amendment to the voters of the state of Oregon. If Oregon's voters approve, Article 11 of the Oregon Constitution would be amended to allow the voters of individual cities, counties, school districts, and other taxing districts to have greater decision-making power about the level and duration of property tax funding they want to provide for their local services. Measure 5 and 50 have disempowered citizens by imposing mandatory state restrictions on local property tax decisions. Permanent operating rate limits allowed by Measure 50 continue to be inadequate for many local taxing districts, causing districts to make reductions as well as turn to short-term local option property tax levies to close funding gaps and maintain important ongoing services. The Measure 5's caps on taxes, exacerbated by flattening real market values, are increasingly causing compression and reducing revenue from local option levies. Keep in mind that a local option levy must be approved by the voters. The Measure 5 compression often takes away part of the voter-approved revenue. These impacts, together with the projected levels of state funding for schools and loss of federal timber dollars in the case of Lane County and other timber-dependent counties, are contributing to a building financial storm for cities, counties, school districts, and other local taxing districts. And I mention districts besides cities because they have an impact on cities as well. School districts and county funding has an impact on cities as well as their own services. In our area, Eugene 4J and Bethel districts serving the citizens of Eugene are already being pounded by the storm, and many cities and counties not far behind. Like many districts, the City of Eugene has dealt with constrained permanent property tax revenue under Measure 5 and 50 through a combination of reductions, efficiencies, and passage of local option property taxes for particular purposes. For instance, in FY10, our fiscal year 10, Eugene successfully addressed a general fund shortfall of $9.4 million, while in FY11, an additional general fund gap of over $5 million was successfully addressed through reductions, efficiencies, and maintenance of some services with local option levy. In our case, it was a voter-approved levy for library services. It allowed us to keep those services fully intact. Eugene's voters have repeatedly supported short-term city local option levies to fund services beyond what the city's Measure 50 permanent operating property tax rate could fund. But a 2-, 4-, or even a 5-year local option levy is too short-term to be relied on for stable funding for important ongoing services. The example that Mr. Novak gave of police staffing is an excellent one. You have to ramp up your operation, you have to train your people, you have to get the equipment, you have to put them on the street, pay the maintenance, and then the funding may be uncertain when it comes time to renew it. HJR 26 will offer a choice of short or longer term funding under local option levies to fit a community's particular service needs and the voters' intent regarding the services to be funded. The city of Eugene has experienced some compression revenue losses in local option levy revenue under Measure 5, but not nearly as much as other cities or as schools. Voters in Eugene have also been supporting local option property tax levies for school districts and even for the community college, as well as for the city. But since schools are experiencing significant compression, they have a much lower cap, only $5 per thousand real market value, whereas general government has $10 per thousand real market value. They're experiencing compression much sooner than cities and counties. We have the example of 4J's local option levy approved with 64% of the voters voting yes. The compression losses this year have caused a reduction of that levy revenue by 50% to School District 4J. That's $6 million in lost revenue. Now, although the City of Eugene is not yet suffering such catastrophic losses in local option levy revenue, yet we will in the future, unless the situation allows different choices by the voters to have sustainable choices that generate sustainable revenue. And HJR 26 will allow much more sustainable choices to be made. Many citizens are looking for ways to maintain and fund the services they value, and they're willing to support it through local property taxes. Our experience shows that. Empowering local voters to make local decisions about funding local services is important. Placing HJR 26 on the next general election ballot will allow Oregon voters to consider making reasonable and necessary changes to Measure 5 and Measure 50 provisions in the Constitution. If the measure is approved in the next general election, local voters would have the ability to approve either short-term or long-term local option property tax levies for services they want, then that would not be reduced under compression.
Chair Barnhart and Chair Berger, members of the committee, unfortunately this morning I seem better able to address the issue of congestion than compression. Then would like to second.
And for the record.
Oh, for the record, my name is David Barenberg. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just want to second the remarks of other members of this panel. What this measure does is empower citizens to make choices that can benefit their communities and to have some truth in levies, meaning that the amount that they levy is the amount that will actually go to provide the services rather than be lost through the mechanisms that we have because of 550 and the compression situation that we have in the metropolitan area. In Portland, we have the issue of any new levies then reducing other levies as they come to be. So this measure would just simply send to the voters, let them make a decision on these modest changes that would help the system function better. Thank you for the opportunity to croak out a few words this morning.
Yes. Representative Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Have you guys performed any analysis to determine why these ballot measures were placed in the Oregon Constitution in the first place? I mean, you know, what were the voters driving at? What were they trying to accomplish with this?
Sorry, are you referring to 5 and 50?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Measure 5 was passed in 1990. Measure 50 was passed in 1997. And in between, there's Measure 47, which was adopted, and then 50 modified Measure 47. I'm not a student of the history of those measures, but I can conclude that there was, at the time, great concern over the rising property taxes and no control over those rising property taxes. And the voters responded by supporting those measures in those separate election years. We've controlled the rising of property taxes. Now it's a different problem that's local taxing districts, school districts, and park districts, and water districts, and fire districts, and cities face. And that's, we're unable to keep up with our revenue. Our normal property tax revenue streams are bread and butter with costs. And people, our citizens, our voters, want services. They want cities and fire districts and counties and school districts to provide those services, and there's just not enough money to provide the level of services they want. So it's an inverse problem now. It's not out of control property taxes. It's inability to generate property taxes to satisfy the demands of the voter.
Follow-up. Thank you. You know, I represent East Multnomah County, and it's really very simple the way things work in Multnomah County. If Portland wants it, they've voted in. And it doesn't really matter what happens east of 205 or east of 82nd. It just happens. And we get outvoted consistently. And my concern, and I hope that maybe you can address it, is, you know, what protections would be in place for my neighbors who are always outvoted on a countywide basis in a place where the overwhelming majority of funds go to benefit places west of 82nd and in downtown? I mean, if I were to support this, you know, what would be the, from your perspective, the way to explain this, that once again we'll be getting outvoted and have no benefit in East County?
Chair, is Representative Wand. And we could discuss each of the some of the different levies that go forward, the children's levies and some of the other pieces or city-specific levies. But I think, you know, it's reasoned debate among the county voters or the city voters or whatever jurisdiction. I think that would take advantage of the opportunities provided here, doing a 10-year levy rather than a 5-year levy and having the impression. So it's a localized discussion. Often the levies are by city. There are levies by county. And it is majority rule in those discussions. I think that raising revenue, raising taxes to raise revenue is always a difficult thing for voters to do, for elected officials to refer to the ballot when they do. But it is, you know, then just subject to the normal debate. I don't have any reassurances that I can give you that protect, you know, a section of the county if somebody refers a countywide measure, other than there in the metro area is a lot of debate, a lot of press, and a lot of attention, and then democracy takes its course.
One possible answer to the question that you've raised is that each jurisdiction would have the authority under this measure, as I understand it.
Yeah.
Which means, of course, that if there was a countywide measure, then the results you're talking about might very well occur. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't be the case for cities or local fire districts or school districts, assuming that they're in the East County area. Yeah, please.
Thank you, yeah. Co-Chair. Just so you guys will understand where I'm coming from, I look at this as a constitutional protection for the minority, frankly. That's the way I look at it. And so I'm looking for a reason to believe that this is one of those instances where the protection of the minority should give way to majority rule. And right now I'm not seeing it yet, but I, as you know, have an open mind, and I'm prepared to keep looking. But it is solely these protections over the last 20 years that have protected East County from getting rolled. These were, my view, these protections were put in to protect folks on fixed incomes. They were a blunt instrument to try to control out-of-control spending at the government level. They worked in some instances. In other instances, we just got fees and application fees and everything else, and government costs continued to go up. So, you know, the way I analyze this, we have to go back to what was the original problem, prove to me that we fixed it in other ways, therefore we don't need this protection anymore. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few different questions. The first one, and kind of piggybacking off of Representative Wands, Metro government, regional government, would they be subject to this as well, so they could invade the Measure 5 and 50 limits as well?
Co-chairs, Representative Vera Brewer, it's my understanding that as a local government, they would fall under this.
Okay. Okay.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Just a couple of questions. Thank you for your indulgence. Mr. Novak, you and I talked briefly about this, and I'm wondering if you had a chance to respond. I'm not familiar with the constitutional limits, but in one of these measures, but we're dealing with two different issues. We're dealing with both the extension and renewal period, but we're also dealing with a tax impact of Measure 5 and 50. Is there a constitutional problem handling these two different issues in one measure?
Co-chairs, Representative Vera Brewer, thanks for that question. It's our belief that since these two items are so closely related, that separate measures are not required, since they both deal with the virtually the same legal rights and limits of local governments in regards to property tax or in regards to taxation.
Does LC agree with you about that, or do you know?
It's been a while since I've had a discussion with them. I'd be happy to follow up.
Thank you.
Please. I don't want to speak for them.
Your next question.
Oh, thank you so much. I actually concur with two of the three elements of this bill, and that's the 10-year option period. It's very expensive to go out, and every 5 years comes quickly. And I also agree and don't find it problematic, the 8-year renewal period, being able to go out at 8 years for 10 years. I am less enchanted with the Measure 5 and 50 impact because I do believe Measure 5 and 50 was the will of the voters and that they spoke about that. So I'm concerned about that. And I am appreciative of your bringing up that local option levies have come about because for local autonomy, those local voters wanted it. But had Measure 5 and 50 protections not been in place, might those voters have chosen differently? Could that be the case? Would they have seen from other local option levies an increase in taxes, and would they respond differently in an environment where 5 and 50 were not keeping their taxes, in a lower state? So I'm sensitive to the local option, local autonomy and local voters, but I'm not sure that historically or statistically that carries a lot of merit because they have been voted in light of Measure 5 and 50. So that's just where I'm at. I do find that part problematic.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? I'm not sure whether you're the right place for me to address my question or not, but I'm going to ask, and you can tell me if I have got it right or not. I'm interested in lines 25 and 26. Those two sections refer to uniform taxation, and I'm wondering why those are in here. Well, it essentially establishes an exception to those two sections of the Constitution, both of which refer to, on the one hand, uniform taxation, on the other hand, the uniform administration of taxation.
Okay. Go ahead, answer that.
And if you don't know, that's fine. I'll ask someone else.
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask LC to confirm this, but I believe that refers to the cap language.
Actually, it's not. It is not. It refers to older language in the Constitution. The second one, Article 9, Section 1, was adopted in 1917. The other one, I'll have to go back and look again to see when it was adopted. But they refer to uniform taxation and uniform administration of taxation, not to measures 55 or 50. But I need to ask LC why they put that in there. No particular reason why you should know the answer to that question. Anything else for this panel? Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Kathy Eaton, you're here this morning. Welcome. And maybe we should bring Morgan Allen and David Williams also, while Cappy's getting up here. Oh, you have three. Let's let Cappy go and then the three of you come up. Thank you. You have been extremely busy. I see you in the afternoon in the Rules Committee.
Yes.
Yes.
Good morning, Chair Berger, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is, as you know, is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization. We encourage people to participate in government when they've been informed about what the issues are. We have some fiscal policy positions that I believe we want to put in place as we look at Measure HJR 26. There are three of them. A tax limitation is justified if it provides safeguards in the regulation of state and local services and economy. A limitation is not desirable if it prevents provision of services, disrupts government functioning, inhibits progress, or results in loss of local control. Second, the League supports a tax system that is equitable, adequate, stable, easy to administer, and as simple as possible. And third, the state should provide sufficient funds to give each child an equal, adequate education. These principles caused the League to oppose Measure 5 and Measure 50 in 1990 and in 1997. Local governments, cities, counties, and school districts are experiencing fiscal disasters as a result of the recession. They have little to no reserves available to mitigate the loss of revenues from state, local, and federal sources. The impact of Measure 5 and Measure 50 limitations, coupled with rising service costs, drastic cuts to state education funding, and lower tax dollars locally, and the generally poor economy, is severe. Closing schools, reducing school days, and laying off teachers are the school district's response. Cuts in critical social and health services for children, families, disabled persons, and treatment programs affect the quality of life in many cities and counties. There certainly is no equity or adequacy among school districts across the state. The League believes that HJR provides a good place to begin the dialogue about the plight of local governments. The current limitations in Article 10, Article 11, Section 11B of the Oregon Constitution must be addressed. We thank you for this opportunity to comment.
Thank you very much. Questions for Kathy? Thank you.
I have one further thing.
Please.
I would like to add.
Go ahead.
Remembering back to the discussion in 1990 when we passed Measure 5. The state voters predominantly voted against it, except for the city of Portland. And so it was carried by those voters that you alluded to, Representative Wand. The rest of the state was concerned very much about funding for schools at that time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Now the panel.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Morgan Allen, representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and we're here in support of HDR 26. One of the things that I'll be coming around to you as part of our panel's handouts is a document that has several pages put together by our friends at COSA. You can see all the organizations, school organizations at the bottom. And what this document does is it sort of tracks K-12 education funding in Oregon over the last 8 to 10 years. And the most important thing that some of you have probably seen some of these documents or all of these documents, but one of the messages that our organizations are trying to convey to legislators is that any way you slice it, whether you look at real dollars, whether you look at K-12's share of general fund and lottery, whether you look at inflation-adjusted dollars, or whether you compare it to how other states are spending on education, there's a steep downward slide in Oregon's investment in K-12 education. The first page, I think, is most illustrative of this. You know, in the 2003-05 biennium, about 45% of the state general fund and lottery dollars went to K-12 education, and under Governor Kitzhaber's proposed budget, we're down below 38%. So that's a significant decrease in the share of K-12 funding over the last few years. And that's why our members support granting authority to school districts to ask voters for supplemental operating revenues from a variety of sources, including the local option changes that are proposed in HDR 26. Right now, there are about 15 to 20 districts that have local options. And one of the messages, or one of the things that we're hearing a lot, is you're probably going to see many more districts going out for local options. We get calls pretty regularly at the School Boards Association from our board secretaries and our board members asking for information. Their district may have never thought about going out for a local option before, but they are so concerned about the proposed level of K-12 funding that, you know, many communities are exploring this option for perhaps the first time. So I think we're going to have a very robust conversation at the school district level about the local option levy under the current limits and hopefully under the changes proposed by HDR 26. So I think before I pass it off to my panelists and friends, I would just say, you know, we support allowing the voters to decide if they want to provide additional support to their school districts outside the Measure 5 and 50 compression limits. And with that, I'll stop there and turn it over to my colleagues.
Mr. Co-Chair. I have a specific question about what this fellow just testified
to.
Can
ahead.
I interrupt?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah. So I'm looking at your numbers here, and you're assessing a decline in funding for education based upon a percentage of the state budget. Are there numbers that that look at the real dollars in terms of the CPI expenses and the population growth and numbers like that?
Yeah, actually, and I think the one example that I would give to the committee that I can think of off the top of my head is, you know, when I was talking about whether you look at inflation or real dollars. For example, when the legislature adjourned in June of 2007, the K-12 appropriation was $6.25 billion, roughly, from the general fund and lottery. The governor's current proposed K-12 budget is $5.57 billion, $750 million less than schools were originally appropriated at the end of the 2007 session. So that's a pretty significant revenue drop in our sector. And, you know, I can come to your office and, you know, we can talk about some numbers you'd be interested in, but there are real declines in our sector.
Follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Please, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And I would like those numbers because my concern when I look at percentages like this is that it doesn't make the point very accurately. It's far more accurate to look at real dollars and real expenditures. But then my second question for you deals with the equity provisions of ballot measure 5, because prior to ballot measure 5, there were a number of jurisdictions in our state, including the Reynolds School District, that year after year was stuck in the safety net because they were failing operating levies. And so all of a sudden, when we passed ballot measure 5 and compelled equity across the state, there were many school districts that got a lot more money than they had before, that suddenly they were able to support their education services locally far better than they ever were before. So that's a point in your analysis that's really important to me, that when you're talking about education funding going down and how horrible ballot measure 5 has been, it's important to tell the whole story. In some places in this state, ballot measure 5 was the savior for their school districts, and in other places it wasn't. But that's a part of the story too. Thank you, Mr. Kushner.
Thank you, Representative. Shall we go on with it? I don't think there was a question embedded in that statement.
Just a comment.
Go ahead.
I didn't hear the inflection going to the Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with Portland Public Schools, here to lend our support as well for House Joint Resolution 26, a new local option levy authority for school districts and other local governments. Really what this is about is just allowing communities to have a robust conversation about levels of funding for their various component governments, obviously our interest in the school districts. I think we've seen, as Mr. Allen referred to, the existing local option levy authority that's inside of existing compression constraints. We've seen a fairly broad use of it for those districts that do have some compression. One argument in favor of an equity position is that HR 26 would provide more opportunity for more school districts, because not every school district has an equitable amount of space inside of those compression limits. But even in that, we've seen pretty broad disparity of the use of the current local option levy authority, obviously from places like my own district, Portland Public Schools, Eugene, Ashland, Lake Oswego, Tiger Twalden. Probably none of these are surprising people. But we've also seen use of the local option levy authority from places like Hood River and Seaside and Siuslaw and Morrow County and Pendleton and Crow, Applegate, Lorain, and Condon and Falls City. So this is not sort of limited to just one sort of voter base or one type of demographic. It's been pretty broadly used throughout the state. And we'll also point to the use of another revenue-raising authority that school districts have that is currently outside of the Measure 5 and 50 limits, and that is, of course, our capital bond levy limits. Districts have had, since 97, when really post-Measure 5 and 47, Measure 5 and then subsequently 47 and 50, those limits really became in effect. School districts have had a lot of conversation around this. In fact, there's been over 300 local capital bond questions been put to the voters around the state, all over the state. I was just pulling up the list here. Places like Helix and Hillsboro and Gresham Barlow and, you name it, they probably had a local bond conversation. Obviously, not all of them have passed. It's been about 50-50 around the state. But I think those that have passed, you've seen an area where school districts have been able to have a conversation with their voters about priorities in the district, and frankly, even those that haven't. They've had a conversation of where do we want to invest our resources in this district? Where do we want to make a choice, whether it be on the capital side or under the limited local option levy authority now, where do we want to invest targeted resources? And you've seen that conversation take place. And my personal opinion is where districts have made a very positive statement with their voters and really sold them on the value of that investment, they've received favorable support from their voters. So we really see this as broadening that opportunity for districts to have that conversation with their voters about an appropriate level of funding. We would obviously be in here every session advocating that you not undermine the existing base of funding for education. I think, as Representative Juan pointed out, there are some positives in that there were districts that had a very hard time prior to Measure 5 maintaining a base of education. It is now the responsibility of the state, of the legislature. In fact, the Supreme Court has said it is the responsibility of the legislature to provide a base of funding for schools, an equitable and preferably adequate base of funding for education. But Above that base, we think it's appropriate for school districts to be able to have additional conversation about where they want to target resources. That's not going to be the same in every community. This community right here, Salem-Keizer, has made choices about investing in music and music education in this district and has, by all accounts, a pretty world-class music program in the district. And they've made that choice based on a variety of opportunities available to them. And we think that this gives many districts an opportunity to have that conversation and make those choices. And would urge your support for HJR 26 and urge, again, not this doesn't raise taxes. What this does is it sends it to the voters to say, do you want to give districts this authority? Do you want to give local governments this authority? And we think that's entirely appropriate.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah,
thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt again, but this got me a little exercised. So you're talking about Portland Public Schools, right? Okay. And in local control, and we have a conversation with voters, and we want to do things differently in Portland Public Schools or Lake Oswego, all right? So what happens if this passes and passes the voters? And 20 years from now, I walk into Lake Oswego, and it is a marble palace. That Lake Oswego High School is gorgeous. And I walk into Lincoln, and they've decided not to go with marble, but they've gone with granite that's beautiful, okay? And then I go into Reynolds High School, which I can do right now, and there are concrete floors with no carpets and no tile. And how does that change, alter our obligation to provide equity in school funding? How do we get there in terms of equity when we know that some of the school districts will take this authority and will make choices that you talk about because they can?
Right.
Because they have the money, they have the income to make these choices that you guys are asking for, but there are other parts of the state that would love to make those choices, but they can't do it because of their economic situation. And how do we address that from Salem if we move forward on this?
Yes. Co-Chairs Barnhart and Berger, Representative Wand, that is an excellent question. A couple of points. One, obviously on the capital side, we have wide inequity right now. If you walk into Lake Oswego High School, you will see a pretty dang nice high school because they've
gorgeous.
Actually completely rebuilt it. If you walk into Cleveland High School, you'll see moldy ceiling tiles falling. So you will see that wide inequity on the capital side. I think in the Measure 5 and 47 and 50 conversations, I think on the capital side, that was not a part of the context. We are, of course, strictly talking about the operational side. I do believe it is the responsibility of the legislature to make sure that they provide an equitable opportunity for every kid in the state to get a pretty dang solid education. Okay? But in the absence...
Excuse me.
Yes.
Are we doing that now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Personally, I don't think you are doing that right now.
Thank you. Go ahead with what you were saying.
And right now, down at the other end of the hall, they've begun their public hearings on the state school fund, which is, I think, the appropriate avenue for having that conversation about the level of investment that the legislature is making. But in the absence of that, and frankly, even in the presence of some greater level of investment by the state in education, we still think it's appropriate for districts to be able to have that conversation about ways to enhance their program locally. With all due respect, they are doing that now in other ways. You see the city of Eugene talking about doing a citywide income tax to pass through to Eugene and Bethel school districts. You see Lake Oswego School Foundation raising almost $2 million a year for their operations, let alone the Riverdale schools that charges tuition for out-of-district kids. So you see that happening now. Districts are having that conversation. What HJR 26 does is allow every constituent in the state to have that conversation. Now, with respect to inequities in property value, which is, of course, this is based on property value. So if you are in a district that doesn't have property value, it is hard to collect the same amounts that a Lake Oswego or a Portland Public. Portland Public Schools has downtown. Obviously, that is a huge property tax base for the district. We are currently contributing to the state school fund about $170 million in local property taxes a year. whereas the number two and three largest districts in the state, Salem and Beaverton, contribute about $170 million combined. So that's obviously a way that the state has dealt with that. Another possible avenue for that, because I think my colleagues here representing statewide associations are very acutely concerned about equity. What we've done with the existing local option levy authority is create an ability for the state to say, if you as a voter are willing to take that leap and say, we want to provide an investment for our school district, we as a state are able to provide you sort of an equitable opportunity to do so. And the way we've done that is say, districts with property value below the 70th percentile in the state, if they pass a local option levy authority, we will equalize them up to the 70th percentile. That's the local option levy equalization grants. And that's been pretty successful. You have a number of the districts that I mentioned, like Pendleton and Falls City, who are receiving those grants. Their voters have said, yeah, we want to do this. We want to make an investment. We're going to raise our own taxes to invest in education. But we're going to do it because we know that we're going to have the same opportunity as places like Portland and Lake Oswego and others. So I think that there are ways to address equity, not inside the framework of the Constitution, but certainly statutorily as we've done elsewhere.
Thank you. Thank you. Please.
Good morning.
We finally get to our third panel. Yes.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Berger and Barnhart and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association, echoing a lot of the comments that have already been made, and I'll try to make a unique contribution. You have my written testimony before you as well. Building on the case around the equity question, that was our first response as well. We, as a statewide organization, care about the kids from the west to the east, the north to the south, and not just in the more affluent communities of Oregon. And we are happy to have worked on the power equalization piece on Oregon's local option law within the gap. We also were worked on the capital equalization, if you will, the November general obligation bond matching money concept that did pass voter muster just in November 2010 to try to offer in the future some possibilities for a state match on the capital side as well. We've all worked as a coalition on these issues for years. We are here today also in support of this resolution because we feel that in addition to the state's obligation to fund schools adequately as well as equitably, according to the provisions of ballot measure 1 passed in 2000, and understanding that the capacity of the state to do so has been insufficient to actually meet that mandate, irrespective of the fact that it's there and there is a shall, and the Supreme Court agreed with us on that point. We realize that that's just not possible at this time, and so we're looking for ways to meaningfully offer the opportunity for local communities to have some flexibility with their ballots in the local level to be able to build over the top of the base those extras that they feel that they have the wherewithal and the desire to do so that students are able to access a higher quality of education than otherwise would be available to them, particularly after this housing bubble related depression of real estate values that have in fact brought more properties into compression and made local option increasingly a rare opportunity for school districts around the state. There's just a handful of districts inside the gap that have any ability to raise anything meaningful from the local option inside the gap. We already have tested, as you've heard before, the desire of communities to locally support their schools with the general obligation bonds. You may remember that in 2009 I brought in a map showing all the places local options and geo bonds and so on had passed in the middle of our recession, just as we were going into the depths of the recession in Oregon. 42% of all the local option and general obligation bond levies for schools, libraries, fire departments, special districts, and so on pass, even in that very, very grim low point. So we know that local communities would use this as a tool, and some would say yes and some would say no, but wouldn't it be a reasonable proposition to simply give them that opportunity to consider that for themselves?
Thank you. Now questions. Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand correct on the proposal is on the Measure 5 and 50 element is to basically say for these options that the Measure 5 and 50 wouldn't apply. And in any particular property, whether residential or commercial, would be subject to potentially multiple local option levies that are where the overall property tax is then no longer contained to a maximum amount. So we could have a city local option levy, we could have a county local option levy, we could have a metro regional government local option levy, we could have school local option levy, we could have a fire district local option levy. So in essence, what we've by passing this now, property owners are now exposed to an unended, unlimited amount of property tax exposure. I mean, is that a true statement by this measure?
Co-chairs and Representative Vera Brewer, I believe it's, I would tweak that statement just a bit to say that all of this, that this resolution would do would be to put it on the ballot to ask the question whether or not local communities want to have the opportunity to consider proposals to do those things. It is still up to the local community then as well for any individual proposition that would come before them to say yes or no to it. And so if they had layers of various different taxing authority, local options or so on approved, yes, that would all be part of their bill. But that would be up to the option of those local citizens, as it is now for general obligation bonds and local options. General obligation bonds are outside the measures of 50 and already. We have seen through history, we've seen this proposition tested. It is not, and we are still right there as a state, somewhere in the middle of all states in the nation in terms of property taxes.
Please.
Thank you. So I appreciate that, but we also know that taxing districts that have a high renter, tenant voter base over property owner voter base, or districts that have a high non-voter property ownership, like commercial and industrial voter bases, that sometimes it's easier when you don't have a direct impact on paying the property tax to vote yes on a menu of good feel things on a ballot, and also those commercial property owners don't have a vote, and yet they would be subject to this. So I am sensitive to that, but it still is problematic. I remember a few years ago in my own area, there were about six or seven different property tax increase things on there, and they sounded good, you know, a pool, and new land for schools, and public safety issues. I mean, there must have been a lot of them. Well, all but one of them passed, and the property tax increase was huge, and we can look through on the numbers of how that passed, and some people aren't sensitive to the actual cost of these. So, and that's more of a comment than anything else. But thank you, Madam or Mr. Chair. I'm done.
Thank you, Representative.
Co-chairs and Representative Arbor, I would like to comment on that because I believe that when property taxes are allocated, they also are reflected in rents, and that's, I know how economists look at the total property tax share per citizen when they do distributional analyses, and it is also true that the folks who tend to vote in low turnout elections especially, but in all elections, tend to be more engaged voters, homeowners, older voters, and so on. It's not easy to pass one of these, and there are a lot of dollars put in on the sides of those who oppose any kind of tax increase with regularity in these elections. I think that that's what a democracy is.
Thank you. Other questions, comments, sir? For this panel. Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on HJR 26? Yes, sir. Please come forward. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Berger, Barnhart, Committee for the Record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. And looking at this bill we're talking about today, I'd like to have you back up a little bit and look at the economic factors of what's happened to rural Oregon. We can't afford anything. With the ONC funding going away, I see this as a bill for the have and the have-nots, and rural Oregon is a have-not. We've allowed the economic backbone of rural Oregon to be destroyed. Drive through the city of Burns, Joseph, Elgin, and in the Southwest. Somehow, we cannot allow anything more to happen in this building to disrupt what little bit of economic factor rural Oregon has. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony. Is there anything else this morning on this public hearing? I wanted to just make a couple of comments. I think Representative Wand and Representative Air Brewer have raised really important issues, ones that I have struggled with for a long time. When I was on the Eugene School Board in the last decade of the last millennium, the Eugene School Board took positions that probably disadvantaged Eugene in order to support the idea of equity across the state for public education funding, for precisely the reasons that Representative Wand mentioned. He's absolutely correct that before Measure 5 passed, there were a number of districts around the state that almost every year had crises in school funding, and some of them even closed in March or April because they ran out of money. There were well-funded districts like Eugene, and I think you mentioned Crow Applegate, Lorain, Portland, Pleasant Hill in my area, and other districts around the state that were much better funded than they are now by a great, great deal. The struggle, it seems to me, is one where their values compete. One value definitely is equity across the state. Children, no matter where they live, have a right to an adequate, and I would say excellent, if we can manage it, education. And there's no question in my mind about that. I've been struggling on school funding since 1993, and it seems as though we continue to go backwards. And I would refer you to the chart in the COSA packet that talks about funding per individual student adjusted for inflation, which is the second page from the, well, the last page that has any printing on it. And it's pretty stark. Adjusted for inflation, we went from $4,700 to $3,700 from 1991 to 2010-11. And I assume those are 1990-91 dollars that we're talking about. And that mirrors my experience very much with how, what has actually happened in our previously well-funded school districts. The year I got involved in politics was the year that Eugene School District laid off 100 teachers. The Register Guard a couple of days ago mentioned that the Eugene School District is considering laying off 84 teachers now, even though the number of teachers in the district has continued to decline, with very few exceptions every year since 1993. I would be the last person to claim that this measure is perfect, or even that it's, well, certainly it's not perfect. I believe, and I think most of us believe, that if we don't provide an adequate, if not excellent, education for our students, our economic future is extremely dim. Future in the world, our ability to compete, our ability to maintain a civilization. And the numbers are stark, and we've been going the wrong direction since 1990. It is a huge, huge problem. I do not believe that any one proposal that anybody makes is going to get us out of the mess that Oregon is in. I don't believe that any of the proposals for restructuring the way we provide education is going to do it. You can't do it without resources. And I don't believe that this proposal will do it. But we need to look at and consider proposals that will do some things that we like and may have effects that we don't like as we explore ways to get us out of this long-term destructive process that is destroying our capacity as a state and as a country. I would hope that as we look at this and other proposals, that we think very hard about how it is that we're going to reverse this trend and start getting it into a posture where it's possible to do an adequate job of educating our kids. I would like to have a comfortable retirement in a few years. That depends upon having an educated workforce. I would submit that those who are younger than I am have an even greater interest in the people who are in school today getting a good education and being able to support them in their retirements. But more important than that, and less prosaic, I guess, is our capacity to have a civilization, to have a democracy, to compete in the world depends upon getting this trend reversed. And we have to think very hard and figure out ways to accomplish that. I think that is probably the most critical thing that the legislature and the state and the people of the state of Oregon have to come to grips with and have to do. We have spent now 18 years since Measure 5 really started to bite, and we are no closer today to resolving this issue than we were when Measure 1 failed in 1993 that would have supported education. Anything else? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing, and the committee is adjourned.